from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. Next on this morning's forum, gun control in California. This state already has the strictest gun control laws in the country. A clutch of new measures are moving through the state legislature to tighten them even further. Among other things, the bills propose to expand the regulations governing the sale and purchase of ammunition, as well as banning mentally ill people from purchasing guns. While we're talking about new restrictions, what's the sense about the laws we already have on the books? Forum begins after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This hour, California has been a national model for gun control legislation. Over the past quarter century, we've passed 45 gun control laws. In California, the purchase of a handgun requires registration, a safety certificate, a 10-day waiting period, and a rigorous background check. All direct person-to-person sales are prohibited, and concealed carry weapons are rare. Now, in the wake of the tragic massacre in Connecticut, the Obama administration is pushing for change at the national level. And here in California, state lawmakers are pressing again to pass new bills to crack down on guns and ammunition. Joining us now to discuss these bills and the larger debate about gun violence, we have Julie Leftwich, legal director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, based in San Francisco, here in our San Francisco studios. And then in Sacramento, we have Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner, who represents the 15th District, which covers part of Alameda and Contra Costa counties. We have Steve Lindley, chief of the Bureau of Firearms with the California Department of Justice. And on tape, we'll also have Gene Hoffman, Jr., director and chairman of the Cal Guns Foundation. Thank you all so much for joining us. And let's start now with Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner. Can you tell us a little bit about the legislation that you're presenting?
Certainly. I just first want to remind all of us that across the country, there were regulations in place around ammo sales, bullet sales, nationally for many years until 1986, where the NRA sponsored legislation in Congress to eliminate those. And the kinds of things that were in place nationally were the seller of ammunition had to be licensed, the person purchasing it had to show ID, and records of the sales had to be kept. So those prohibitions that exist, whether in state law or federal law, about certain classifications of people with convictions or people that have been known to be a danger to themselves or others, are not allowed now in most states to buy ammunition. But there's no way to really enforce it. And so that existed. But then it was taken out across the country. So what much of the legislation you see now, my bill, Senator Kevin De Leon's bill, is trying to put back into place some of those same controls or regulations on ammo sales as we had in place nationally.
Obviously, the proposal, the compendium proposal that Vice President Joe Biden is putting together is still a work in progress. But do you see anything directed at ammunition in those talks?
Well, so far, the kind of indicators of what Vice President Biden is talking about does not include, at least to what I've seen, anything on ammunition. And I think the motivation for many of us, I represent Oakland, for example, where there were 131 gun deaths last year. And we think about what makes a gun deadly. It's bullets. And today in California, it is easier to buy bullets than it is to buy cigarettes, alcohol, or even certain types of cold medicine. And that just doesn't seem to be appropriate. So many of us would like to see the ability for law enforcement to enforce our existing laws on bullets. And unless they have some more tools, that's very difficult for them. And we'd also like to see law enforcement notified if someone tries to amass huge quantities of bullets in a very short period of time, like what happened in Aurora, the shooter in Colorado. He purchased over 6,000 rounds of bullets in a very short period of time with no one knowing.
Well, Gene Hoffman Jr. of the CalGUNS Foundation wasn't able to join us this morning, but Michael Krasny did have an opportunity to talk with him earlier, and we did ask him specifically about your legislation to regulate ammunition sales.
Quite a bit. Those people who actually train, and by the way, those are the people you want to have training. You certainly don't want untrained individuals with firearms. They buy ammunition in the 1,000-round count, and that's because it's very common during a training session to go through 500 or 1,000 rounds. What we're fundamentally talking about doing is making it very hard for people who are poor to be able to buy ammunition. We're going to drive prices up by forcing people to shop at retail instead of allowing them to shop online as well. And those are really, really bad ideas. I mean, look, the same concept could be applied again to religious text or abortions. I mean, maybe everyone needs to have a background check and a license, and maybe somebody shouldn't have an abortion after month five. These are all the sorts of rules that really don't apply to civil rights. If you have the civil right to own a firearm, you should be able to use the existing background check you'd already take to be able to buy the firearm in the first place, and use that to as a proxy, the fact that you can buy ammunition.
So, Assemblywoman Skinner, any immediate response to that?
Well, certainly. We, as the previous speaker talked about, there are many safeguards into place right now in our state around the purchase of guns. But there are no such safeguards around the purchase of ammunition. So while if I want to purchase a gun, I have to have a waiting period, I have to have a background check, I can buy bullets most anywhere. I don't have to show ID. There's no record of the sales. And the person I purchased the bullets from doesn't have to be licensed. So law enforcement, if they're trying to enforce that which exists, which means that, you know, if I've been convicted of certain things, I'm not supposed to buy bullets. If I have certain mental health issues, I'm not supposed to buy bullets. But since I can buy them anywhere, there's no ability to really enforce that. So really what we're talking about is trying to put some of those things into place.
Let's take the conversation now to Julie Leftwich, again, legal director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. What do you think of this idea of tackling the ammunition as opposed to the guns?
Well, we're very pleased that these innovative bills have been introduced. I would just echo some of Assemblywoman Skinner's comments that ammunition sales are almost completely unregulated under existing law. So it's legal for someone, for example, to sell ammunition out of the trunk of their car, no questions asked. Ammunition should be treated like firearms because firearms are only lethal when used with ammunition.
Steve Lindley of the California Justice Department, you know, mentally ill loners grab the biggest headlines, but most of the gun deaths in California happen in poor neighborhoods, typically as an outcome of gang warfare.
Is that a question or a statement?
Well, I'm just wondering if you think that what we're talking about controlling now is kind of nibbling at the edges of the problem or really addressing something at the heart of it.
I think it addresses someone at the heart of it. Firearms can't work without ammunition.
And do you think that Skinner's bill addresses the concerns that you have from your perspective at the Justice Department, or is there something more or something less you'd like to see?
Well, without looking at the finer details of her bill, I do look forward to working with her as well as the Attorney General's office in order to see what actually we can pass that will be effective in enforcing some type of or preventing gun violence.
Well, you mentioned here what we can pass, and there is this year a Democratic supermajority in both the state assembly and the state senate. So presumably, Assemblywoman Skinner, anything's possible?
Well, our legislature has already shown that they have a willingness to act on this issue. Now, Senator De Leon, when he was an assembly member, carried a bill that had similar provisions in place around handgun bullets, handgun ammunition. Now, unfortunately, that bill, which was signed into law by Governor Schwarzenegger, has been held up in court because of what the court ruled as a very vague definition around handgun ammunition. So I think what he has a bill that has some features that are slightly different than mine, but together, my bill, AB 48, and his bill, a Senate bill, would put into place, would first regulate all ammunition and put into place much of the same types of safeguards that we now have in place for gun purchases.
There have been a lot of governors around the country, particularly in the Northeast, who have come out very strongly in favor of new gun control laws. That hasn't been true for Governor Jerry Brown. He's been largely silent on this issue. Do you have a sense that you've got a receptive audience there?
Well, actually, Governor Brown has signed some of the really most significant gun control legislation that has been passed in the last decade. Just in the last session, he signed into law some very good bills. So I think if something is reasonable, if it is something that law enforcement feels assists them in the enforcement of existing laws, and that would actually help us reduce gun violence and gun deaths, you know, I would hope and I think that Governor Brown, you know, may be supportive, and we'll have to see. We'll have dialogues with him, obviously, and we'll see.
Julie Leftwich, we have, as Skinner just mentioned, bills passed recently, bills in the works, and now New York is considering gun reform legislation of its own that makes it a little dodgy to say that California has the most stiff gun control laws in the country, because that could change any moment now. Do you see anything going on in New York that you would like to see discussed here in California?
Well, we are very encouraged about what New York is considering and what the Senate passed last night. In particular, the idea of prohibiting large capacity ammunition magazines that can hold seven bullets, which the typical definition here in California is more than 10. And that's what the number was under the expired federal ban. So that's encouraging. I know the state also... the Senate also passed a bill to require the reporting of lost or stolen firearms. That's a crucial piece of legislation that, unfortunately, Governor Brown vetoed here in California last year. And I understand that the New York legislation also includes ammunition purchaser background checks, which is crucial, and what is being considered under the new De Leon bill.
Steve Lindley, we were talking a lot about the collecting of information, databases, and there are multiple databases at the national and at the state level to track who's buying guns, what, where, why. Are these databases comprehensive enough, effective enough for the needs of law enforcement?
In California, I believe they are.
And that's true, even though we seem to see a steady flow of sometimes quite military firearms in our state's urban centers?
To define what that would be, an assault weapon is tricky. We do have regulations and laws here in California banning the use of assault weapons, but the gun industry has time on their hands. And when some of these laws are passed, they're reflective of that period of time. You know, add 5, 10, 15 years to that, and they find ways around some of our assault weapon laws, some of our high-capacity magazine laws that we have here in California.
I can't help but think of in recent weeks we've had a number of gun buybacks in different localities across California, and, you know, taking advantage of the public's awareness of the issue now following the massacre in Newtown. And you see these pictures, not just of, you know, semi-automatic weapons, but rocket launchers in some cases. It does seem like there is a steady black market trade in some pretty serious firearms.
Well, to speak to that, I think most of us welcome the President Obama's willingness to take leadership on this, and looking forward to what Vice President Biden's going to put forward, because we need these laws nationally. You can have great laws in California, but then if you can skip over to Nevada or another state and purchase the kinds of weapons that we've regulated or we've banned, then it really it hurts our efforts to try to limit and control these weapons. So we do need federal and national legislation and a level playing field, because that's one of the factors that really lessens the effectiveness of California's actions.
And what we understand is that Biden is considering talking with Congress about measures that might reinstate the ban on military-style assault weapons, banning large-capacity ammunition magazines and so forth. But it does also seem like they're taking seriously the idea they might be passing a lot of executive actions in the Obama White House to sidestep Congress and get some things done without Congress's approval.
That's a difficult one to speak to yet, just because we haven't, seen the full proposals.
Yeah.
But I think most of us would welcome some good national action, because it only strengthens what we are doing here in California and our effectiveness.
So along those lines, let's turn now again to Gene Hoffman Jr. again on tape. When we talked to him yesterday about efforts to beef up the state's firearm laws, he said the existing regulations are sufficient.
Well, of course, California law is one of the most aggressive in the entire United States. And in some ways, it's been positive. We have universal background checks, and we actually have an excellent mental health referral and disarmament system that seems to work. Yes, I mean, in fact, when people went to their experts on the kind of Democratic side of the House in the K Street, they found out that most of the proposals that they wanted to propose were already law.
So there we go. Assemblywoman Skinner, let me just throw that to you first, that there's already an excellent system in place.
So what he was referring to were those laws that we have on gun sales. And it's true. We are a good model on our laws around guns, the sale and purchase of guns. But we don't have, as Ben mentioned, we have little to no regulations on the sale of bullets. Some of the key features, for example, of my bill is that it would put into place some of the procedures that we have on the purchase of sale of and guns on all ammunition, on bullets. But additionally, it also would ban the sale of what we call clip kits that, in effect, undermine California's assault weapon ban. California has an assault weapon ban, but you can legally buy these conversion kits that allow you to turn your gun into something that can shoot multiple bullets very quickly without you having to reload. So one of our things we want to get rid of is those clip kits. The other thing that my bill would do is enable law enforcement to be alerted if someone amassed significant quantities of ammunition in a very short period of time. And that's really to address this mass shooter type of situation, because we have seen some evidence that those people who engage in these kinds of, you know, multiple shootings at once often will buy that ammunition over a very short period of time.
Julie Leftwich, I want to ask you, no doubt you saw the headlines a couple weeks back about the Ontario Gun Show. It's one of the biggest in the country. And, reporters who went to go see the masses, there were people lined up outside the door to get into that show, many of them saying that they couldn't wait to buy new guns for fear that, you know, the walls are going to come down on those sales. Is that something that troubles you, the sense that perhaps our legislative leadership is moving in one direction, but that a lot of the populace is moving in the other direction?
Well, our understanding is that when people go out and buy a lot of guns in anticipation of stronger gun laws, it's typically people who are already gun owners. So people who own guns often like to own a lot of guns. And so it's not so much that new people, people who don't already own guns, are going out for fear of new gun laws, as it is people who already are collectors.
And do you have a sense of whether that's a regional thing, a lifestyle thing? Are we talking about urban versus suburban versus exurban, or is it just really statewide?
Well, our understanding is that it's more rural versus urban, and it's they're typically people who own more guns or live in rural areas as opposed to urban areas, possibly because those in urban areas see the devastation that guns cause in their communities.
Should people who either live in rural areas or visit on a regular basis to do things like hunt, should they worry that they're not going to have access to the tools that they need to pursue hunting?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's when you hear President Obama talk about his hesitance about whether or not Congress will even pass an assault weapons ban, there's really no rational basis for anyone to fear that they're not going to be able to hunt or own a handgun in the home for self-defense, which if I could just comment on Gene Hoffman's reference to civil rights, and there's a lot of misinformation out there about the Second Amendment. So is it all right if I just take a moment to
– For sure. Yeah.
Okay. Prior to 2008, the United States Supreme Court and the lower courts had held that the Second Amendment only protected a right to possess a gun in connection with a well-regulated state militia, which is what the Second Amendment says. But in 2008, there was a radical change in that jurisprudence when the U.S. Supreme Court held for the first time that the Second Amendment guarantees a right of law-abiding, responsible citizens to possess a handgun in the home for self-defense. So it was a very narrow holding. But since then, the NRA and other gun groups and a lot of criminals who'd been convicted of gun-related crimes have been challenging federal, state, and local gun laws under the Second Amendment in response to this decision, the Heller decision. But it's important for people to understand that although there have been hundreds of lawsuits, they've been overwhelmingly rejected by the courts, and that the Second Amendment right, this new Second Amendment right, is a very narrow right. So people don't need to worry. They do have a constitutional right, if they're law-abiding, responsible citizens, to have a handgun in the home for self-defense. So the government is not coming to take away anyone's handguns in their home.
Well, let's talk about go ahead, Assemblywoman.
Well, I was just going to indicate that what the courts have repeatedly shown over multiple decades is that, yes, there is that constitutional right, but it's also a right that we are entitled to have well-regulated. And they have upheld many and most of the regulations regarding that.
Let's talk about the people who are ineligible to own guns. Steve Lindley with the Justice Department. The Justice Department has got new legislative tools in its toolkit, from what I understand from the last legislative session. Tell us a little bit about how that's strengthened your hand in terms of making sure people who are not allowed to have firearms don't have them.
Well, one of the major bills that were passed last year that we'll see implemented in January 1st, 2014, is the retention of long gun information. Currently, when someone in California purchases a handgun, we retain that information in our automated firearm system, which is available to law enforcement. We are prohibited, as of now, to retain any long gun information. That would change in 2014. That will be a valuable tool for law enforcement so they know what firearm somebody has. That also cross-references with what California has is very unique in the nation is our armed prohibited person system, which identifies people who had purchased a handgun or registered an assault weapon either from 1996 or back to the assault weapons back to 1989. And it cross-references that with a number of our databases to see if they've now become prohibited. So at one time they illegally purchased the firearm, they have subsequently become prohibited, and it identifies those individuals so both local law enforcement and the Department of Justice can confiscate those firearms from people who have lost the right to possess them in California.
And have you already begun to make use of that database to reclaim guns that are in the hands they shouldn't be in?
Yes. The database was brought online in April 2007 for local law enforcement. Since then, the Department of Justice has been investigating those armed and prohibited persons. We've investigated over 9,000 individuals and confiscated over 10,000 firearms, mainly from violent convicted felons and people with some type of mental health prohibition.
We're talking about gun control in California this hour. We'll take a short break and come right back, but we'd like to hear from you when we do. Are the solutions you're hearing proposed the right solutions, or should lawmakers be focused on something else? Call us at 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions. We'll include them in our discussion when we come back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about gun control this hour. In the wake of the awful massacre in Connecticut, and really a steady drumbeat of awful shootings across the nation is reconsidering our gun control laws, and California is reconsidering, too. We've got a number of guests here. Let me reintroduce Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner of the 15th District, which covers Alameda and Contra Costa counties, Steve Lindley of the California Justice Department's Bureau of Firearms, and Julie Leftwich, legal director of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence based in San Francisco. And this half hour, Michael Hammond, Legislative Counsel for Gun Owners of America. Thank you, Mr. Hammond, for joining us today.
Thank you, Rachel, and hello, San Francisco.
Hello, San Francisco. Well, I want to look across the water, Assemblywoman Skinner, to Oakland, where some of those awful headlines I was referring to have been coming from this last couple of days. And I'm wondering whether you see gun laws either at the national or state level impacting or being a player in the terrible situation that's going on right now in Oakland?
Well, Oakland, sadly, is one of our cities with a large number of gun deaths. In California, on average, for the last 10 years, we've had statewide about 3,000 people a year who die from gun deaths, and about that same number who are hospitalized from gun deaths, which is a tragedy. But what Oakland sees is that without any real ability for law enforcement to enforce the issue of who can buy bullets and who can't, and with the fact that people can buy guns out of state that are prohibited in our state, or they can buy guns out of state without being put into our Department of Justice database, which has been talked about earlier, that it just puts weapons in the hands of many more people than we ever intended should have them or are allowed to have them. And so national action and statewide action will help law enforcement deal with these problems in communities like Oakland.
There's a California lawmaker at the national level, Adam Schiff, who is pushing a bill to allow victims to sue gun manufacturers, which is another way to sort of approach this issue. Michael Hammond with Gun Owners of America, your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, we've been there before. We had 37 jurisdictions, many of them in California, try to bring frivolous lawsuits against gun manufacturers for the ostensible purpose of putting them out of business, and that effectively was made unlawful by legislation which we participated in getting passed by Congress and signed into law by George W. Bush.
When you hear the conversation happening, especially at the national level, about where gun control legislation should go, are you one of those who believes don't touch it, don't touch the law at all? Or do you think there are tweaks that could basically reestablish confidence in the American public's mind that only the right people have guns?
Well, in a sense, I believe don't touch it, in the sense that don't make it worse. Connecticut was one of the five most anti-gun states in the country. I mean, it was illegal for Lanza to have the gun, illegal for him to steal the gun, illegal for him to put it in the car, illegal for him to take it from the car, illegal for him to have it in the school, and, of course, illegal for him to kill people. But none of that gun control had any impact on stopping that horrific tragedy. And, of course, our hearts and minds all go out to the victims of that horrible shooting. But the intriguing thing is that states such as California, which have the most pro-gun control stances in the country, nevertheless have the most shooting deaths, whereas states such as my own adopted state of New Hampshire, where virtually anyone can get a gun who wants to, have homicide rates comparable to any country in Europe, or perhaps lower than it. So people come to us and say, well, yes, it's true that we have gun control. It's true that it's done no good in our state. It's true that you don't have gun control. It's true that you don't have homicides. But if you change your laws to be like our laws, maybe it will change the outcome in California. I don't think anyone who thinks about that could conclude that makes any sense.
Julie Leftwich, I see you eager to respond there.
Yes, I would strongly disagree with what Mr. Hammond just said. Gun laws do work. We track all the gun laws in all the states in the country and have determined that California has the strongest laws. But not only that, you must look at the rates of gun deaths, not just the gross numbers. And from 1993 to 2010, California's firearm mortality rate declined by 56.6%, which is 27 percentage points more than the decline in the rest of the nation. And as you had mentioned earlier, California has had, I think since 1993, had adopted more than 30 significant gun laws. So there is, although causation, you know, gun violence is a very complicated issue and it's difficult to provide strict causation, but it's clear that gun laws play a crucial role in reducing gun deaths and injuries.
Well, we could Assemblywoman Skinner?
I just want to say, in addition to gun laws, in California, we have a number of cities, Los Angeles, Sacramento, and others that have, there's not a limit in California for a local county or city to put in regulations around ammo sales, bullet sales. In Sacramento, for example, which my bill, AB 48, is patterned after Sacramento's ordinance, has a bullet seller has to be licensed, the sales are recorded, local law enforcement is then alerted, and as a result, the city of Sacramento has been able to move in and confiscate weapons from people who they've now know are buying bullets, who are in the category of prohibited from doing so. So they've been able to confiscate weapons that they otherwise wouldn't have had access to, and they've been able to, they are very, very supportive of their law. And we have law enforcement all up and down the state who are asking, you know, we can't just do it city by city because someone can then just jump across the street. We'd like to see these kinds of things statewide.
Michael Hammond, I know you want to jump in there.
I seem to be the only Christian in the lion's den.
All right, but quickly, because we do want to get to the phones this half hour.
Well, first of all, New Hampshire, states like that have lower per capita rates than most countries in Europe. It's not just a question of having a lower number because of California's higher population. Secondly, if California declined relative to other states according to the handgun control numbers, I wonder what states we're talking about. Illinois, which confiscates more guns than any other city, and Rahm Emanuel bragged about it, clearly hasn't seen its gun deaths go down relevant to anyone.
Well, let's put everybody into the lion's den now by turning to the callers. Michael in Pengrove.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, what's your question?
It was a little bit of a question, a little bit of a statement. I feel that a lot of the gun laws that have been enacted in the United States in the last few years have been, or in the last, 10, 20 years, have been relatively ineffective. Not because of the intention, but more because of a lack of knowledge by a lot of the lawmakers about the guns or about the crime or the problems. I'm an EMT, and I've got a lot of friends who are paramedics, firefighters, police officers, ex-military that shoot. And, for example, this ammunition thing, when we're talking about purchasing large amounts of ammunition, I know 10 or 15 guys off the top of my head that purchase thousands of rounds at a time. When you deliver the information to the local police department that someone bought 2,000 rounds, more often than not, it's not going to be effective in any manner because there's tons and tons of people. There's probably 20 or 30 people in my small town right now that are going to be purchasing it, thousands of rounds today. The police aren't going to be able to use this information well.
Assemblywoman Skinner, would you like to address that?
Well, obviously, if skeet shooters, for example, they use 1,000 rounds, at once. And so certainly we have not yet set the threshold of what number we would actually have local law enforcement alerted. And we don't want to have people alerted just because of a skeet shooter buying ammunition. So we will certainly make that threshold much higher. But I think if you're local law enforcement, what you'd be doing if you're given that information is you'd be looking at your database to see whether that purchaser was already in the prohibited class. And if they were in the prohibited class, then they may act. The skeet shooter, by and large, or the duck hunter or whatever, is not in the prohibited class. So I think they should feel assured that this is not going to be trying to interfere with their ability to use their recreational sports.
Steve Lindley, would you like to address that? I mean, it does seem like a database in this day and age would be sophisticated enough to tell the difference between somebody with a felony record and, you know, a law enforcement officer who likes to hunt on the weekends.
And we have that system. It is the armed prohibited person system, and it can identify that. So one of the ideas is to run people through that and identify someone who is already prohibited from possessing a firearm and who's currently trying to purchase ammunition. Again, right. It doesn't go after your law-abiding gun owner. It goes after somebody who has done something in their life to become prohibited.
Michael, does that answer your question?
Can I say two things about
reasonable,
that?
Reasonable, but it still seems like a drop in the bucket, unfortunately.
All right, sorry. Is this Michael in Pengrove or Michael Hammond?
This is me. Can I say something?
All right, we've got two competing Michaels.
it's a popular name.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Michael in Pengrove. We're going to go now to Michael Hammond. What do you make of what you're hearing right now?
Well, a couple things. First of all, if you want to hate me even more, I'm the one responsible for ammunition not being regulated at federal law. It was originally regulated under the 1968 Gun Control Act. It was deregulated by McClure-Volkmer, Firearms Owners Protection Act of 1986, which I managed for Senator James McClure. Interestingly, I don't think anyone thought that between 1976 and 1986, as a result of the regulation of ammunition, that crime rates or homicide was going down. Rather, after it was deregulated, crime rates began to go down, and they went down because I think of a prevalence of three-strike laws. Secondly, as to the question of whether people in the database have done something bad in their lives, there are probably about 150,000 veterans come back from Vietnam, or not Vietnam, but Iraq or Afghanistan, sought counseling, and as a result, the VA put a fiduciary in charge of their affairs and sent their names as prohibited persons to West Virginia. I think most of us feel that these are honorable men who serve their country well and who shouldn't be in that database as a result of simply trying to seek treatment.
I want to put this question to you as well, Michael Hammond. This is from Ken, who emails, the U.S. won World War II with the M1 rifle, which had an 8-bullet clip. Why does anyone need more than that to hunt or to defend themselves?
Well, the first gun I was issued was an M1 rifle. I was issued it when I was in junior ROTC in ghetto high school. And we as 14-year-old kids walked up and down the playground, up and down the school halls with our semi-automatic guns, fully functioning. Everyone looked at those. They didn't have any firing pins, but you couldn't tell that to look at them. And it didn't occur to anyone in the world that we were going to shoot up the school. So the notion that a time in which there were guns, semi-automatic weapons, which were in schools and which were prevalent, was somehow less dangerous than today is not accurate. Secondly, I mean, look at, and let me give this as an example, the Korean merchants in Los Angeles during the Rodney King riots stood on their roofs of their stores with their nasty-looking semi-automatic guns and their big clips, and as a result, they and their families weren't burned to death. My brother went through the same circumstance when he woke up in the middle of the night with a drug dealer standing over his bed. So I think it's a little presumptuous to tell these people what they do or don't need in order to protect their lives.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out, sir, that a lot of Korean business owners did lose their businesses to fire. And, you know, to some extent, you have to say it would be nice if everyone was in a position to defend themselves, but that situation doesn't always present it itself. You sometimes find yourself completely unable to defend yourself.
Doesn't
it make more sense to set up a larger situation where the social harmony is such that those situations happen less frequently?
Well, I was in the District of Columbia where guns were completely banned. It's the only time in my life where someone had actually put a gun to my head and begun to pull the trigger. So we've tried that experiment in a number of jurisdictions in the country, and in America it hasn't worked. The reason it hasn't worked, among other things, is that there are 300 million guns out there, and it is never going to work. And the only guarantee someone has is the ability that to defend their families, if necessary, from the risk of harm. We saw with Newtown, the FBI profiler, Clint Van Sant, was on TV all day that day, indicating that the reason that people like M. Lanza chose venues like Newtown was because they knew there would be no guns there. Why in heaven's name do we want to advertise to the Adam Lanzas of the world that you can come into this venue, shoot up a kindergartner, and we will guarantee you that no one will be able to shoot back?
Well, with that, let's return to the phones. I want to give our listeners a chance to weigh in here. Felix in Richmond.
Hi, good morning. I'm one of Ms. Skinner's constituents and recreational shooter. Love picking my neighbors up to the local ranges to teach them basic marksmanship and firearm safety. And I typically order a couple cases of ammunition every time I do because it's the local gun stores just don't have a large selection, and ammunition is incredibly expensive. So I have to order this online, and it's shipped either to my office or to my doorstep where hopefully no one steals it. And so I think under Ms. Skinner's bill, all these shipments must then be directed to a local dealer who, I'd like to know, do these dealers even have the capacity to store and to ensure all of these shipments that will be coming to their doorstep instead? And more importantly, the fee that's going to be attached for handling and sending whatever information, you know, her bill contains to the government. You know, typically when you purchase a firearm, there's a transfer fee of $50, and then there's additional fees on top of that. So I think this is an incredible burden on gun owners.
Assemblywoman?
Well, actually, there are two bills that have been introduced in the legislature regarding ammo, mine and also Senator De Leon, and the one our gentleman from Richmond was just referring to that would require the face-to-face and non-internet sales is actually Senator De Leon's. My bill does not yet have a number in it in terms of the quantity of ammunition that would trigger local law enforcement being notified. And so certainly my purpose is to have the kinds of interactions with recreational shooters, with hunters, with others about what is appropriate so that people like Felix who are, going to the shooting range and such are not so impacted by this legislation.
Does that set your mind at ease, Felix?
Well, I as long as the threshold is high enough where, you know, it's not completely Orwellian, you know, maybe perhaps above 3,000 rounds or something like that, then I would be fine with that. But it's the burden that Senator De Leon's bill would place on gun owners. That's my primary concern.
Well, and I appreciate hearing from gun owners about these kinds of concerns so that we can tailor the legislation to do what we want it to do, which is to really help law enforcement prevent deadly ammo from getting into the hands of people who should not have it.
Dave emails, we need an insurance requirement for gun ownership. All gun owners should be required to carry a liability policy as car owners are. Give a law some teeth with a steep fine or jail term for failure to insure. We'll never limit possession and ownership, but we can regulate the use and storage. Julie Leftwich of the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, does that sound like a better way to go?
I think that's certainly something worth considering. I'm unaware of any state that requires gun owners to obtain liability insurance, but it certainly makes sense. Automobile drivers have to obtain liability insurance, and guns are just as lethal, if not more lethal, than automobiles, so that requirement seems quite rational.
Michael Hammond,
The issue of requiring insurance has been in quite a few articles recently. They're in national and local press, people basically advocating that there should be this insurance requirement. So it's an interesting subject.
Michael
Can
Hammond?
I comment on that?
Yes.
That's one of the reasons why Gun Owners of America got involved in the fight against Obamacare and why we got language exempting basically gun from some of the insurance requirements. The fact that you require insurance, and it was certainly uncontroversial on Obamacare, and then at that point you begin to ratchet up the premiums to the point where gun ownership essentially becomes unaffordable. And I think we all see the danger which lies in this proposal, and I think we understand that the intent is to make it even more difficult to exercise your Second Amendment rights.
This kind of follows along those lines. Valerie emails, she would like to take inspiration from Chris Rock, who thought that if one bullet cost $6,000, that we'd see a commensurate reduction in violence. And she suggests taxing bullets at a very high rate, such as 5,000% or 6,000%. The money, she says, could go for domestic violence and violence against women programs. I don't know if anybody wants to take up that. Yes.
Yeah, we in fact did that, or the Clinton administration attempted to do that by taxing Brady check requirements. Initially, the tax would be about, what, $42, and then it would go up and up and up and up until effectively gun ownership was taxed out of existence. What we did at that point is Senator Bob Smith offered an amendment which would prohibit Clinton from doing that. And again, we understand that some people think that gun ownership could be taxed out of existence, but guess what? A lot of bullets out there. Bullets now are in the hands of what Wayne LaPierre would call the bad guys. And if you can't afford a bullet to shoot back, then you and your family are at risk.
Let's turn again to the phones. Joan in Oakland.
Hi. What amazes me is why nobody is talking about licensing the way we license drivers. You have to take a test. You have to show that you know the rules. And you have to show proficiency before you can be allowed to drive. Guns are far more deadly. And, I think that if guns were licensed to some of these other problems, it would be easier to track, for example. I think that would solve some of the problems.
Julie Leftwich, do you want to comment on Joan's suggestion?
Yes, actually in California we do have a licensing requirement. Gun purchasers have to obtain a handgun safety certificate, which shows that they understand the laws of the state. It does not include a hands-on proficiency test, which I think would be a good idea.
Can I comment?
Yes.
They did have a licensing requirement in Connecticut. In order to purchase a handgun, you need a handgun license. It wasn't effective in stopping Newtown. In addition, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, is talking about pretty much a comprehensive license and a comprehensive database for firearms in New York. And not surprisingly, he is on the front page of the New York Times, also talking, once they have that database, of going around and confiscating.
Well, Steve Lindley, I don't want to forget about you there in Sacramento. Any thoughts about the licensing laws that are already in place in California?
Well, like Julie said, we do have the Handgun Safety Certificate Program, which requires the purchaser of a handgun to get the certificate. They have to pass a firearm safety test with a minimum of 75% pass rate, and they have to also show a safe demonstration of the operation of that firearm, mainly the handguns, before they can pass the test. So we do have some steps there. Can that be broadened maybe to all firearms so people understand the safe handling and the laws that are affected by the firearm ownership? Yes, but again, in California, we're kind of on the cutting edge of a lot of these laws. Can they be improved? I think they always can be improved because they're set at a certain time under those issues, and we see how we can maybe improve those laws over time. But California does have that. We're proactive as far as identifying people who are prohibited and already have firearms. We do a background check. We do background checks on all purchases, whether it's through a dealer or through a private party transfer. We have a lot of those things in place, things that the federal government are looking at adopting. A lot of those are coming from California.
But again, I wonder, those are all for gun sales and not for ammunition.
Gun sales. I want to go back to Steve Lindley and ask you about mental health, whether that's something that ticks up when there are handgun sales, and in what capacity. Is it possible, as Michael Hammond suggested, that a vet who might have been written up for PTSD would raise a flag in the database? Are we effectively watching people with very serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia being blocked from purchasing handguns?
If those individuals have been brought to a mental health facility and have sought treatment, oftentimes involuntary, yes, that is reported to the Department of Justice. Sometimes that comes from the VA. But one of the statistics that the Department of Defense just put out, that I think it was in 2012, they saw more suicides from their soldiers than they saw deaths in combat. Again, our soldiers are coming back. They've done an incredible job for this country under very difficult circumstances. But they're coming back with some mental health issues that we need to solve for them. But during that time frame, it might behoove us as a society to protect them sometimes from themselves and make sure that we get them the proper treatment and they're not going to be a danger to themselves or others until we can rectify some of the problems that we gave them by them serving in our country in a combat zone.
Assemblywoman Skinner, I do want to ask very quickly, can you tell us, are there any efforts in play right now in Sacramento to address mental health care?
In California, we have a funding mechanism that was a proposition sponsored by our Senate pro tem, Daryl Steinberg, that is in place. And so that we have, compared to many other states, more mental health services offered. Due to the economy and the budget cuts and such, some of our mental health services were impacted and they've been reduced. And I think there's overall a commitment to try to strengthen those and to definitely provide more assistance to our veterans and to others who really need it.
And with that, I would like to thank our guests, Assemblywoman Nancy Skinner, Steve Lindley, Julie Leftwich, Michael Hammond, and Gene Hoffman Jr., who, as you recall, joined us last half hour by tape. Form is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns, we can never forget our interns, are Jessica Chung, Nora McCartan, and Gina Shalaba. I'm Rachel Miro. Thank you for joining us this morning, and please feel free to continue the discussion online at kqed.org/forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.